It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning. Welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Bill Bransford, and I'm your host this morning. Today, we're going to be talking about the upcoming federal dispute resolution training to start at the end of this month. And to help us talk about that, I have four different guests who will be participating, one right after the other. And so you're going to learn a lot about the latest cutting-edge principles of different parts of federal dispute resolution. You're going to learn a lot in this hour, but you will learn even more by attending the federal dispute resolution training. To get us started, and before we get started, let me give a quick reminder to our listeners that Fed Talk is brought to you by GEICO, where 15 minutes could save you 15% on car insurance. For more information on GEICO, go to geico.com. Also, if you'd like to join our discussion today, because we will be talking about some current and sometimes controversial topics, give us a call at our toll-free number, 1-877-936-9333, or you can email us at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. Our first guest this morning is Dan Gephardt from LRP Publications, and Dan spends the better part of the year actually helping to get the FDR conference ready to go. Dan, welcome to Fed Talk.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me.
So can you tell me a little bit about what FDR is and a little bit of its history and how it's got to be such respected training?
Sure. Well, FDR was actually started about 28 years ago by an EEOC employee, and over the time since then, it has just grown tremendously, and it's actually the premier conference on federal dispute resolution. And I don't think a lot of people understand the amount of time and the cost to the federal government in trying to deal with employee grievances, employee complaints, workplace disputes in general. So FDR has really been the conference that helps with the latest legal guidance and with best practices and great presenters, really help to resolve workplace disputes, help agencies avoid claims, help them better manage their employees, so we have a more efficient government.
If just one grievance or MSPB appeal or EEO complaint can be avoided by someone's attendance at FDR, that more than pays for the cost of attending.
Absolutely, not even close.
So who should go to FDR? Who's the training for?
Well, it applies to a lot of people. HR professionals, specifically people in employee relations or labor relations. That includes union officials, EEO professionals, civil rights officers, anybody who has any role in alternative dispute resolution or conflict resolution. Anybody who's a manager or supervisor can learn a lot from FDR. Attorneys and general counsel as well. And the neat thing about FDR that we've always done, and I think specifically what we're doing this year, is in a lot of these sessions, these people with different titles are going to be in the same room together learning the same things. And I think that's part of the problem is the lack of communication sometimes
between different stovepipes?
Yes, exactly. So it's a great opportunity for people from those different areas to get together and find the right solutions and best practices together.
Now, are there opportunities at FDR for these employees and these different functions to network and get to meet each other?
Yeah, that's another great benefit of FDR. We several places for networking opportunities, including something that's really taken off the last few years is our informal networking, which is done at the end of the day, after the sessions, and that informal networking is broken down into specific areas, EEO, HR, alternative dispute resolution, and that just grows. And that's one of the neatest things, seeing at the end of the day, after a whole day worth of workshops, that people are going out there and spending their beginning of their evening time continuing to try to help each other out even more.
And Dan, can you tell me what types of trainings are available at FDR?
Sure. We've got six different tracks, including a lot of the areas I've said already. We have a lot of, actually more than 50 breakout sessions that really deal with nitty-gritty on issues like FMLA, diversity and inclusion, pre-decisional involvement for our LR professionals, alternative work schedules, employee discipline. And particularly one session I'm looking forward to is JoLynda Johnson from the EEOC is going to be talking about the evolving law on sexual orientation and identity.
And that has evolved over the last 2 years or so.
Absolutely.
Significantly.
Yes.
So that's something that any agency professional that deals with that area should be aware of the consequences of what could be viewed as discrimination based on someone's sexual orientation.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me whether FDR meets any of the training certification requirements?
Yes. Well, for EEO counselors and investigators, there is two opportunities to get your 8 hours of required refresher training for every year. CLE credit will be available for attorneys, and we're actually going to have a session that will meet most states' legal ethics training requirements.
So that's for lawyers continuing legal education requirements.
Yes. So lots of opportunities for that.
So there are actually the types of training that federal employees would be required to take periodically is offered as part of FDR training.
Yes. Yep.
Can you tell me a little bit about the return on investment? I mean, that's been a subject of some debate, and it does seem to me that by someone going to FDR, there's a benefit, not just a week away from the office.
Right. And, you know, I know it's tough budget times, but, if anybody would take a look at the agenda that we have, as I mentioned, 50 plus sessions, FDR is very cost and time efficient. Than say trying to go to different webinars or bringing in a presenter to the office. There's just so much there to be gained in the networking opportunities. One thing that we've been doing the last couple of years, and on our website we actually have a video on how to get the most out of your conference attendance and how to bring that back to your agency. And last year we had some sessions teaching people how to take the training that you get here to go back to your office and train the people who maybe couldn't go.
And do you know if that worked?
Yeah, I've heard from a couple presenters who are a couple people who went to the conference, came and had asked me a couple questions about what they were doing. So it helps save money, and I know that's important these days, and gets everybody on the same page. You know, and what we were talking about earlier too, just the cost of litigation for an agency is substantial, and when you think about where some of these cases and complaints stem from, is just a mistake somewhere along the way that easily could have been avoided.
And it seems to me that while it may be difficult to measure cases that were never brought, mm-hmm. if in fact a manager or an EEO professional or an HR professional handles something correctly, it's more likely that the complaint will not be filed. And right there, you're saving yourself $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 worth of resources, which is far in excess of the cost of attendance at the program.
Absolutely. And then also take a look at, how workplace law is changing. Just in the last year, we have the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act. Last week, there were three Supreme Court decisions that have some type of impact on EEO and HR. You've got all these issues related to furloughs now.
And next year, RIFs.
Yes. Yep. So we have a session on that this year as well, on furloughs and RIFs. And so the opportunity to get ahead of this and avoid those costs down the line, that's where you get your return on investment.
So these are tough budget times, Dan, and yet this training is very important. So hopefully agencies can find a way to fund their employees continuing to go to FDR so that they could continue to get this return on investment.
I hope so. I hope so. I've been involved with FDR just for the last few years, but you know, I've been very well aware of it and its reputation in the community before then. And this is one place where you can get a lot of guidance and get a lot of bang for your buck. And there is no fluff here either.
There's no fluff at FDR. And I've been involved in FDR actually since 1992, and I serve as the program chair and work closely with Dan in getting the program together. And it becomes, I guess, the last couple of months, at least, Dan, it's been a major part of your life putting FDR on.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. How can people learn more about FDR and how to register for the conference?
Well, I would go to the website, fedconferences.com/FDR. There you'll be able to see the agenda, see all the great speakers we have. You'll be able to register. There will also be a short video there with tips on how to get the most out of your attendance and bring it back to your agency. You can follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, also on Twitter at hashtag FDRCONF.
Okay. Dan, thank you very much for being on Fed Talk this morning. When we come back, we'll hear from our first presenter. We have three of them lined up. They'll give us a little bit of a preview of what they're going to be talking about during their workshop presentations. This is Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around a mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is Geico anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that Geico isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how Geico actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, Geico saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like Geico. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. Geico.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com. Then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact Geico today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Bill Bransford, your host, and I think joining me in just a few minutes is going to be Joseph Swierczewski. He's going to talk about his FDR training program on PDI, pre-decisional involvement, and I'll talk just a little bit about it before he gets on. He was on the line before, and we lost him, but we'll have him back in just a second. First of all, I would mention that Joe Swierczewski was previously the general counsel of the Federal Labor Relations Authority, and also has some extensive work since that time in dealing with training and contacts with the federal community, particularly in the area of labor law and things like pre-decisional involvement. Joe, are you there? Joe Swierczewski, this is Bill Bransford. Are you there?
Bill.
Joe, it's good to talk to you. I'm not sure I can hear you well.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Being on my cell
phone. You're on your cell phone. You're not coming in very clearly. Do you think you can go to a better place? Okay, Joe, I had mentioned to our listeners before you got on the line that you had been the general counsel at the Federal Labor Relations Authority. I think I was even had a previous appearance on Fed Talk in that capacity, so you're not a stranger to our program.
At all.
Okay, Joe, tell me a little bit about what you're going to be doing at FDR on training concerning pre-decisional involvement.
I
Joe, yeah. You're breaking up a lot, and maybe it would be good if you called back, and perhaps we could get a better connection.
Okay, I'll try to call back on the regular phone.
Oh, wait, man, that sounds good. That sounds good.
Okay.
Okay, tell us about pre-decisional involvement.
You can hear me now fine?
Yes, I hear you now.
Okay. Pre-decisional involvement is a process contained in the executive order on creating labor management forums, and it's a mandated process for management. It requires that managers engage in pre-decisional involvement in all workplace matters. And what my session is going to deal with is the values of engaging in this process, the values for management, values for the union. And I'm also going to talk about what the boundaries are, because in my practice, I've probably developed, I would probably say, 30 or 40 different forums. And I found that in actually constructing the forums, there was a lot of discussion about pre-decisional involvement. It's probably the preeminent thing that we spend the most amount of time on. And what's the confusion part to both management and union is the boundaries to pre-decisional involvement. And what we'll try to do in this session is explain how pre-decisional involvement can work effectively and how the parties, when developing it, should try to establish an understanding of what are the values of it and also what the boundaries are. That's a major problem, is understanding that pre-decisional involvement is a process. It's a process that both parties should develop jointly. The National Council on Labor Relations issued guidance on pre-decisional involvement, but it really, to be frank with you, is not very helpful. It doesn't prescribe or give any real understanding other than to say that the parties themselves should figure it out. And to figure it out takes some hard work, and they have to really work at trying to understand what pre-decisional involvement is going to do for them. And what I'm going to be talking about are how they can, in a sense, figure it out, how they can work more successfully, what the benefits are, and what the restraints should be to make it to work well for both of them.
And Joe, when the executive order, when President Obama's executive order on labor management relations was first issued, of course, it had provision mandating B1, not B1 bargaining, but PDI. And I remember being at the FDR training and going to one of the informal network sessions that Dan Gephardt just talked about, and hearing a lot of anger on the part of labor relations specialists and managers who were involved in collective bargaining, because they felt like when they did PDI, they opened up to the union, they tried to develop a relationship, they did exactly what the union wanted to. Them to do when they did PDI, and then all of a sudden they come in with a request for collective bargaining on the decision that's been made, and they felt a little bit like they had been a little double crossed, I guess, because they thought they were doing what they wanted, and then lo and behold, they find out the union wants more. And so I remember that being vocalized. And can we talk a little bit about how as the labor and management get together and do PDI, they can minimize the things that may cause distrust or anger in the process?
Well, that's a very common issue. And, you know, quite often management feels that the PDI process gives the union two bites at the apple. And what I try to do in developing the forums is we talk about what I call the six steps to PDI. Because PDI should be a structured process. It isn't just something that just happens. The parties should understand what they're getting into. And one of the most important steps of this six-step process is making clear what the expectations are of both sides. In other words, management expects that engaging in PDI, that the union is going to waive its right to bargain after the PDI process, and that it should make it known to the union. And quite frequently, unions are not going to waive their right to bargain in pre-decisional involvement, because for most agencies, PDI is not the end of the process of implementing a change. Quite frequently, PDI is just a process where labor and management work together to try to improve the decision-making on a particular change that management's going to make. But then management reserves the right to make a decision on that change, and is usually made by a group, not the forum or not the organization of labor and management working on the PDI. In other words, frequently, PDI is just a recommending body. It's a recommending process. It recommends to more senior management. And because it just only recommends, it doesn't make final decisions, the unions reserve the right to bargain. And what is always a misunderstanding is that if it is only going to be a recommendation, if there is no decision going to be made, then it should be clearly understood that the union is or is not going to waive its right to bargain. In other words, it's the expectations that must be clarified right at the beginning of PDI. Management, what do you expect from the union if they engage in PDI? And union, what do you expect from management if they engage in PDI? Union, do you expect that this decisions on the PDI subject are going to be made by consensus? Management, do you expect if the union engages in PDI that they're going to waive their right to bargain? And both of those two things must be clearly understood, because that's where the problem comes in. When one side or the other feels that they're taken advantage of, management feels that the union requests to bargain, and why do we go through PDI? And union feels, why are we bothering with PDI if the people at the table participating can't make any decisions? And what we'll try to do at the session is go through how to work through and how to establish those expectations so that PDI makes more sense to both sides and is of value rather than creating more problems in the relationship.
And Joe, I noticed that one of the things your workshop is going to cover are those issues and topics that are important to PDI versus what's relevant in B1 bargaining, which I inadvertently mentioned a few minutes ago. Can you explain to our audience what B1 bargaining is and how B1 bargaining relates to PDI or pre-decisional involvement?
Okay. B1 bargaining is under the statute, the Federal Service Labor Management Relations Statute, 5 U.S.C. 7106 B1 is a section of the statute that is, in essence, an elective session for management. Management gets to decide whether they want to bargain over various subjects, predominantly numbers, types, and grades, methods and means, and technology performing work. Management gets to decide, do we want to bargain over the numbers and types of employees assigned to a work unit? Management has no obligation to bargain over those subjects. It may decide it wishes to bargain over those subjects. It's at its option. Union cannot force management to do that. So in relation to the executive order, many people, and having, as I said, been involved in probably well over 30, developing 30 forums around the country over the last couple of years, many people have had a lot of experience in partnership in the Clinton administration. And partnership in the Clinton administration and the partnership executive order issued by President Clinton mandated, or at least attempted to mandate until the federal court said otherwise, mandated that both labor and management participate in B1 bargaining. This executive order, the Obama executive order, does not do that. And this created a lot of angst for many of the union on the union side because they believe that this executive order was just like the Clinton executive order, which it isn't. This executive order does not mandate B1 bargaining. However, it does say, in the process of pre-decisional involvement, should you deal with issues that are B1 issues, which are numbers, types, and grades, example, technology, methods, and means, don't let them stand in the way of working successfully together to create a better workplace. And that's probably the big distinction. In this executive order, management has no obligation to engage in B1 bargaining. And consequently, but it does, in the process of pre-decisional involvement, discuss issues which would be B1 issues, such as methods and means. It's just not obligated to bargain over them. And that's quite a confusion to people who are very involved in partnership.
And I do believe, Joe, that there are the executive order also mandates that there be pilot programs and that there are several pilots operating where B1 bargaining is done.
Right, just in pilots alone, not a universal mandate as was found in the Clinton executive order on partnership.
Are there some best practices, Joe, that managers should be aware of in dealing with B1 bargaining?
B1 bargaining or not B1, excuse me, not PDI.
I don't mean B1 bargaining, I mean PDI.
Yeah, probably the best practice for many of them is they're not doing it. The PDI, the best practices are to consider it to be a structured approach. In other words, don't consider it to be something that you just sort of do. Make sure you sit down with the union and you line out, number one, what are the topics that are subject to PDI? In other words, that's a big issue. The executive order says that you'll engage in PDI on all workplace matters, which is extremely broad. And unions think that that means all workplace matters, which is exactly what it says. The problem is that creates problems because it's impossible for both sides to do PEI in all workplace matters. So both sides must sit down and discuss and decide what issues are appropriate for PEI. And that's one of the things that the National Council on Labor Relations guidance says. Sit down and work out what are the things that you're going to have PEI for. The next thing a manager should think about is when should the union be involved? I mean, when in the process? It doesn't mean the minute you have the idea. It says it's at a point in where you've feel that further action is going to be taken to study it. That's what the executive, the National Council says. That's when you should do it, when you think you're going to go forward with it. So that's an important point to the unions. It's an important point to management, when the union gets involved. Decide that ahead of time. And if you're late in getting them involved, there's ways that you can work together to catch up. The third is most important is make sure it's clear what your expectations are for the union's involvement. That's probably the key one. Make sure you know that if you expect the union not to engage in bargaining, you should ask them, do you expect to engage in bargaining? If they say yes, then you should look at how you conduct your PDI. And that should be something that's important to you. And then the last of which is they should understand the process they're using for obtaining information and for resolving any disputes. The key thing that managers should recognize and understand is this is not collective bargaining. This is a process, a problem-solving process, to try to improve and make a more successful and efficient government. It's very different than what we would have thought of in partnership in many ways.
Joe, thank you so much for being with us on Fed Talk this morning to give us a preview of your part of the FDR training. And I think all of our listeners can tell that Joe is an immensely qualified and capable presenter, and a lot can be learned from going to FDR and listening to the rest of his workshop. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we will talk to Barbara Haga, who is also a presenter at FDR. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
GEICO's famous for saving people money on car insurance. And now, if you're a federal employee, you could be saving even more. In fact, you may already qualify for a special federal discount from GEICO. If you're a federal employee, or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, FLIOA, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you could be saving hundreds of dollars. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings. GEICO got its start back in 1936, specifically to serve federal employees. Today, we're still making it easy for federal employees to save money on car insurance. If you're a federal employee, you may qualify for a special federal employee discount. Or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you may also qualify. See how much you could be saving. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings.
I'm Bill Bransford, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Fed Talk brings you inside information on hot topics in the federal community. From the halls of Congress to federal agencies, get the latest on the laws, regulations, and activities that directly impact federal employees. Tune in to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, as we bring in the experts to bring you inside the issues.
Back to News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm your host, Bill Bransford. If you would like to join us in our conversation here about some of these topics we're discussing, you can give us a call directly, 1-877-936-9333, or you can email us at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. We're now joined by a perennial speaker at FDR, Barbara Haga. Barbara, welcome to Fed Talk.
Thanks, Bill. It's nice to be here.
And can you tell us a little bit about your background and the kinds of training programs that you do at FDR?
My background is primarily employee and labor relations. Really, I specialize more in the employee relations area and spent a lot of time doing training on leave-related issues and performance and discipline and those kinds of things. And so I have a couple of workshops at FDR, one on technology-related misuse, one on performance, and then we're going to be doing an employee relations think tank where the participants are going to provide the information. We're going to talk about some of the big problems that face folks in our business and their agencies.
And that employee relations think tank is one of several think tanks that are really designed for the advanced practitioner that has a lot of knowledge and experience already.
Exactly.
So that people can learn from each other.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me, Barbara, about this abusive technology program. I think that's somewhat new to the FDR training.
It's a topic that, you know, I've done presentations on for a couple of years. Like most things, you know, as time goes on, you know, disciplinary problems in the workforce tend to change, and this is one that's relatively new. You get all kinds of misconduct. I mean, some of it's the pornography at work variety. We also have some cases that I'll talk about in the workshop that are about folks who didn't do pornography. They didn't do anything that was, you know, that violated an agency regulation, but they certainly weren't working. And so that's another piece. And then, of course, there are a few cases, and I'm sure many folks are familiar with not the guy that took the VA laptop home, and then it was stolen from his house, and it had millions of veterans' records in it. We have those kinds of cases where people aren't following procedures to protect data or that kind of thing.
And so one of your topics I see you're going to discuss concerns social media, when it's personal versus when it's work-related. How do you draw that line?
Well, that's probably the hardest line to draw. I mean, some of these things are really obvious, like the pornography and that kind of stuff. You've got an agency policy that's going to say if you use a government computer to access that, you're in big trouble. But with things like social media, it's a question of when it's gone beyond reasonable use. And that seems to be what most agencies have, is sort of a reasonable use approach to computers and cell phones and that kind of thing. But clearly there are times where it goes beyond reasonable and it starts to impact work. And that's when the manager needs to step in and make sure there are clear boundaries about, you know, when we've gone beyond reasonable.
Barbara, what if you're on your personal time, your personal computer, and your personal Facebook account, and you post something that's extremely critical of your supervisor, and you name your supervisor by name? Is that work-related or private?
Well, there are a couple of decisions already where Facebook evidence has been used. So far it looks like the MSPB, when it's about a work-related issue, they're treating it as within the government's purview to deal with. One was a Postal Service employee that posted something that was judged to be a threat on a Facebook page. There was another one where a VA employee was engaging in an inappropriate relationship with a patient, and Facebook posts were used to prove that. And then there was another one where a Navy police officer posted on Facebook that he had called in sick, but he wasn't, and it was used in that case as well.
So it's interesting that that the agencies were able to even find this personal information. I know that, you know, they have access to government emails, but how do agencies find this stuff on Facebook?
You know, in the case of the VA employee, the patient eventually came clean and admitted that there was a relationship. I don't remember in the other two cases, but, you know, lots of times people friend their coworkers and their supervisors, so they may find out that way.
That's, I have to tell you, I when I first had the opportunity to friend somebody at work, I declined. I just didn't seem like it was the right setting or the right idea. But one of the things that still amazes me is that the number of federal employees who don't think that their agency can come in and look at their government email account because it's theirs. And that's just so untrue.
That's right. And the GSA guidelines have been out there since 1999 that clearly say that a federal employee has no expectation of privacy when they're using their government computer for whatever. So there's no defense on that one. If they get caught doing something that they shouldn't have done, it doesn't matter that it's, you know, their email account.
And I read an article in Federal Times this week about apparently the Department of Education going through all of their employee emails looking for either the words Obama or McCain, I think it was,
uh-huh,
and then turning the emails over to the Office of Special Counsel for Hatch Act violations.
Right. There's the Special Counsel has put out guidance, and that's one of the things that I recommend in the workshop is you need to stay on top of that. And once every 4 years is not enough, because people really don't think about the fact that they posted something on a page that a little lower down has a button that says contribute to this campaign. That's a violation in the OSC's eyes. And it's gotten so complicated because, of course, of the access of technology.
So how can a manager tell if an employee might be abusing workplace technology?
Well, in most of the MSPB cases that I've reviewed, these are not subtle. These are blatant. People coming into the building at 1 o'clock in the morning when they don't have any official business there and downloading child pornography. Or it's thousands of emails and thousands of folders. In one case, an IT manager gave a woman access to everything in their entire system so they could instant chat each other because they were having an affair. So they're not subtle things. They're usually going to be obvious about the amount of time, the amount of material on the computer, you know, that kind of thing. And many of these folks are sending it around to coworkers.
So, Barbara, talking a little bit about performance actions, and I do some training on performance. And when I do the training and the managers I listen to tell me that they avoid performance actions because they think it's so much hard work. And so I try to spend some time telling them how they can simplify the hard work. And I'm wondering if you have a similar pitch that you offer in your performance action training.
That's exactly what I talk about, because they're not that hard. They just take a while. They take some diligence, but the process is pretty simple. And, in fact, I was at a conference a year or so ago when Peter Broida was presenting, and he said he didn't know why federal agencies weren't doing more of these, because they were pretty easy to win. So,
Yeah, that's my take on it. Mm-hmm. But the agencies feel like it takes so much documentation, and then they have to write a 50 or 60-page book on the employee's performance deficiencies, and you really don't. I mean, you can write a 3 or 4 or 5-page memo about what happened, what happened before the PIP, performance improvement plan, mm-hmm. what happened during the performance improvement plan, and the documentation is essentially the day-to-day feedback that the supervisor gives the employee on the work that they've already performed.
Right.
So it's not that hard.
It's not that complicated. It's I think in a lot of cases our HR folks and attorneys have sort of learned the lesson that it's too hard, and they're passing that along. But, you know, you don't have to review everything. There's board case law out there that talks about sampling. As long as you have a neutral method of choosing what you sampled, you don't just sample when somebody calls and complains, then you can sample. You don't have to review every single thing. And the higher the grade of the job, the more of that you can get away with. And I think also that folks have been taught that performance plans have to be perfect. They don't. You can use all those day-to-day communications to flesh out what those performance standards mean. So I think they're fairly easy. I've done quite a few of them.
And when you, as Peter Broida said, he doesn't know why agencies don't do more of them because they're easy to win. Can you give us a quick, simple explanation of why a performance case is easier to win than a conduct case?
Well, first of all, the burden of proof is less, so the actual amount of evidence that the judge needs to sustain your action is less. And that was by design. Congress put it together that way back in 1978. Probably the best thing about it is the MSPB can't mitigate your penalty. So if you win it, nobody's going to be asking you, why did you choose removal instead of a 90-day suspension? You don't have to answer that question. It's not relevant. The thing that's easy about it is basically you've only got evidence from one person. It's not like discipline where usually you've got, you know, maybe witness statements where somebody saw something happen. This is the supervisor's judgment pretty much all the way through. And so they really are, you know, procedurally are pretty simple. It's just one chance to get better. And at the end of the day, all management's got to walk out of there with proving is one element is unacceptable.
And the judgment is a key thing, but the judgment does have to be reasonable.
Absolutely.
And it's not that hard for a well-intentioned supervisor to articulate a reasonable judgment and win in a performance case.
That I would agree. I think, you know, the you got to be able to explain the standards, what they mean, and how you applied them. And again, as long as it's a reasonable explanation, that's good. And as far as, you know, grade levels, the board's been pretty clear. You know, higher grade positions are usually dealt with a little more strongly than, you know, doing cases on lower grade, you know, clerical
and,
type
and
jobs.
More subjectivity is allowed in interpreting
absolutely,
the standards
yes.
for higher graded people.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara, thank you so much for that preview. I think all our listeners can tell that there's a great deal to be learned at the workshops offered by Barbara and all the other presenters at the FDR conference. And you can see how what Barbara has to offer would apply to any federal manager or supervisor, as well as the professionals that deal in federal dispute resolution. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Roslyn Brown about some EEO issues. This is Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Bill Bransford, your host. We're on 1500 AM, Federal News Radio, and I'm now welcome Roslyn Brown. Roslyn, welcome to Fed Talk.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing good. And you've been a guest on Fed Talk before,
yes, so you're
no stranger here.
Yes.
And I believe when you were a guest on Fed Talk before, you were working in one of your numerous positions around the federal government as an EEO professional in some capacity.
I love this kind of work. I really do.
And how long did you work in the EEO field, Roslyn?
I started before you... in 1974 with EEOC as an investigator and moved up through the ranks from there. When I retired 4 years ago, I was EEO officer for the intelligence community. I worked for the Office of Director of National Intelligence.
And Roslyn, you didn't actually retire. You just retired from your federal government job, right?
I retired from the federal government. You're right.
Because you're still doing a whole lot of things in the EEO area. Right?
Yes.
And so anyway, you're going to be presenting again at FDR. And I know you, Roslyn, just for the benefit of our listeners, is one of the best received presenters at FDR. She has a great deal to offer, and she offers her information in a very informative, comprehensive manner. Tell me what you're going to be doing this year at FDR, Roslyn.
I have three workshops that I'm doing. I'm doing a pre-conference workshop on resolution techniques and writing the settlement agreement. I'm doing a panel discussion with three other people on 50 nuggets. We call it 50 nuggets from the ADR Wall of Fame, where we talk about each aspect of the ADR process and the benefit of our collective wisdom and techniques to get issues resolved with the parties. And then the third workshop that I'm doing is relatively new for FDR. We did it last year. It's called the Think Tank for EEO Professionals. And I've heard you say several times that FDR is such a networking opportunity. But, you know, the Think Tank really brings people out of the hallways of networking or break sessions and really brings them into the classroom. We corral that same networking opportunity, but now it's in a workshop. where we talk to one another about issues that are raised, issues that you're going through as an EEO practitioner or EEO manager. Someone else in that room is going through it, or someone else in that room is an attorney or a labor relations specialist who can say, here's how we did it in my agency. So those are the three, and I can't tell you which one I'm the most excited about because I'm excited about doing all three.
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit first about the 50 nuggets, but before I do that, I would like to mention that Barbara Hager, who was just on the show, talked about the think tank for HR professionals, which, of course, is designed for advanced practitioners. So even if you've been around a while and you have lots of experience, there are new things to learn, new perspectives, and you can learn a great deal from your colleagues. And I think you're doing
the same thing. The arena that we work in, there's just so much to learn. It doesn't matter how many years you've been doing it. You can sit in a workshop and still learn something else. And for me, I also learn about teaching techniques and presentation techniques. So that's the double bonus for me when I sit in.
So Roslyn, on this 50 Nuggets, I was talking to one of your colleagues on the panel about what kind of a program to put together in an EO area. And we were brainstorming, oh gosh, it must have been 6 or 7 months ago, and came up with this 50 Nuggets and the idea of the ADR Wall of Fame. And we got the four presenters. But it sounds like, my involvement stopped when we decided on the subject matter of the workshop and the title. And it sounds like you and your colleagues have done a great deal of work to put together a really interesting workshop.
Yes, it's going to be so interesting because unlike other 50 nuggets or 60 tips in 60 minutes, there are parts of the mediation process that we're going to talk about that we don't all agree on, and that is because, well, as you know, mediation is an art. So we're all different artists. We all have different techniques to get the parties to resolution. And so we decided very early on that we agreed with the 50 nuggets, but we said during the workshop, we're going to jump in and basically say, well, I don't necessarily agree with that approach. Or here's an alternative way of looking at that particular step in the ADR process. So we're hoping to make it very interesting. We've agreed to go into our separate corners. There'll be no fisticuffs, but we agreed in a good-natured way to disagree with one another.
So you're going to actually have disagreements so people can hear different perspectives.
Yes.
And learn from that rather than just hearing one, well, this is the best way of doing it.
Yes. I mean, for example, with the agreement to mediate, I mean, I've always done it one way and the way I've trained or whatever, but one of the panel members basically says, well, I bring it to the mediation and I read it at the meeting. And I said, that would drive me crazy. If I'm sitting in a mediation and the mediator does that, I would probably get up and walk. That drives me crazy. Give me the document ahead of time. Let me read it if I have questions. You know, so we have a different perspective on whether or not the agreement should be given out ahead of time and signed ahead of time or discussed at the meeting or actually read at that opening session. So that's one of our differences. The other one was the caucus. Again, most mediators are trained that you have your opening statement, you have your joint discussion, and the various techniques that you use during the joint discussion. Then you have your private caucus. You know, that's just pretty standard. Well, again, the panel doesn't agree on whether or not you need to take that caucus. Is the caucus a tool or is it a process step? And there's really no right or wrong approach. I'll say that up front. There's no right or wrong approach. And if you've been a mediator for a while, a lot of this will be intuitive. It'll be situational. You know, what works in this situation might not work in the next one. I remember years ago at FDR, I was listening to two presenters, one of whom is still a presenter. And I'm not sure whether he said it or or the other presenter said it, but they said, if you're in a mediation and the parties start to argue and they stand up and they're in each other's face, what should the mediator do? And the trainer said, well, the mediator should stand up and be eye level with them and try to separate the parties. Well, lo and behold, at some point in my mediation practice, that happened to me. The party started arguing almost right from the beginning. They were yelling across the table. They stood up. And by the way, these were two agents, so they had guns on them. So I stood up to try to separate them, and they paid no attention to me. So I said, okay, that doesn't work. But the presenter basically said this worked for him in a situation that he was in. So that's the beauty of having four panelists with a great deal of experience and a whole lot of perspective on what works here. This worked in this situation, but it might not work for you. It's really intuitive. You really have to be an artist at your craft. You have to have different tools in your toolbox when you conduct mediation.
So, Roslyn, ADR comes up a lot in the EO arena, but not necessarily only in the EO arena. From your experience as a trained and experienced mediator, who should use ADR? When is it most effective? What kinds of disputes?
Well, I would say that both parties should use it. I mean, it's advantageous for both parties. I know some agencies will decide that certain issues are not appropriate for mediation, and that's harassment. I'm not sure that I necessarily agree with that, because you need to have the right person at the table and not necessarily the harasser. If the harasser is the management official, obviously you wouldn't have that person at the table. But, you know, and I got into this discussion when I was at Treasury. It's like, well, I think maybe you should bring it forward. And if the party chooses ADR, I think we should find a way to try to make it work. But they had certain issues that were excluded. Personally, I believe that both parties could certainly benefit from ADR. Both parties have to work together. They have to communicate. They have to try to resolve this conflict or any other conflict that might arise. They have to build good relationships to make it easier to work through future conflicts. And I definitely think that both parties should participate. It certainly resolves issues early. It's less costly than an investigation. And frankly, when it's done at the counseling stage, most settlements don't even involve, you know, monetary, you know, resolutions. It's other things that are thrown in.
Do you find that the use of ADR is successful most of the time?
In my experience, yes. It was for me, but like I said,
for you as a mediator.
Mediation is such an art that if you really want to be good at it, you really have to do it often. After your training, I got trained years ago, back in the 1990s, 1992, 1993, with DC Mediation, the now Center for Dispute Settlement. And the way they trained us, we got cases through the court system. Once they took you through the 40 hours of training, you had, in order to get certified, you had to commit to coming down to the court once a week to mediate a case.
So, Roslyn, we have about a minute and a half left. What types of behaviors, from your experience, by supervisors lead to EEO complaints?
Say it again, Bill. I'm sorry.
What types of behaviors by supervisors lead to EEO complaints?
Okay. Well, again, my experience is that allegations of not dealing with harassment appropriately or swiftly, timely, certainly mishandling requests for reasonable accommodation or other disability compliance matters. And then the third big category is obviously engaging in retaliatory actions subsequent to a person's EEO complaint.
And retaliation could probably best be defined as changing the way you treat an employee.
Yes.
In a negative way after they've gone to the EO office.
Most definitely.
And you see that occurring a lot?
That happens. Actually, retaliation is the most frequently filed basis of discrimination, according to EEOC's FY 2011 annual report. It's been a consistent trend for the last 5 years, and in the 5 years before that, retaliation was in the top three. In the last 5 years, it's been the top basis for complaint filings.
Roslyn, we're going to have to wrap up. We are out of time on Fed Talk, and I hope all of our listeners will see you and be in your workshops at FDR. And that's all the time we have for today. And I'd like to thank all of our presenters for what they had to offer. A great deal of good training presented at FDR this year, starting the week of July 29th in Orlando, Florida. Thank you very much.
Thank you.